You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature and to the fifth episode of our series, Feather and Flock, in which the ecologist Anya Murray and the folk musician Brian McLean turn their attention to Ireland's wild birds. And this week, we're going to the seaside as Anya and Brian's bird is the tern.
Welcome to Feather and Flock. My name is Anya Murray. I'm an ecologist and a writer, driven by a love for the natural world. Together with my friend Brian McLean, a renowned folk musician, we have been making these programmes to explore and share the wondrous world of some of Ireland's most iconic birds. In this episode, we delve into the world of terns. These are exceptionally elegant and romantic little seabirds who breed along Irish coastlines each summer.
I'm Brian McLean. I'm a singer, musician and songwriter, mostly with my group Ye Vagabonds, and I'm also a bit obsessed with all the wild creatures who live around us, especially birds. Because I live near the coast in County Wicklow, I've been watching terns come and go every year from their nests along the shingle beaches here, and I often see them on the islands around Arnmore in County Donegal, where I spend a lot of my time. I love watching and hearing them each summer when I'm out and about, but terns are not defined by where they nest, but by how they migrate. Just after they learn to fly, they take to the high seas and embark on an unbelievable migration, flying across the open oceans and crossing continents in search of daylight and food. To honour this journey, the songs and score I've written for this episode are influenced by seafaring musical traditions, from big ship sea shanties to the small cabins of single-hand seafaring barges.
Rise up, my little darling. Rise up, my little darling. Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mammy-o. We're fishing on the shingle in the morning. Mother, will I know when I'm for leaving? Mother, will I know when I'm for leaving? Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mammy-o. We're fishing on the shingle in the morning.
Summer evening's walk along Dublin's coastline will almost always be rewarded with the sight of terns in flight. Terns are wonderful to watch, graceful and easy to recognise. They're silvery grey and white with black capped heads, orange beaks and orange legs. Their distinctive forked tail streamers have earned them the folk name of sea swallows. Terns are the ultimate globetrotters. Each of the five species of tern that breed in Ireland make impressive journeys, mostly travelling down the coast of Africa and back again. And one species, Arctic terns, make the longest migration of any bird. Those that breed in Ireland in summer fly all the way to Antarctica and then back again, the equivalent of flying around the circumference of the Earth twice, plus another 15,000 kilometres. The scientific name for the Arctic tern is Sterna paradisiae, translating as tern of heaven or tern of paradise, because these birds experience more hours of daylight than any other organism in the world. To find out more about exactly how such tiny seabirds managed to complete such epic journeys each year, Brian and I met with lifelong ornithologist and author Anthony McGeehan, who has written the ultimate guide to this very topic, To the Ends of the Earth, Ireland's Place in Bird Migration.
Anthony, I'm seeing a whole load of terns and gulls lined up on the railings here. They look very alike.
Yeah, superficially there's a lot in common because the gull's got a pale grey back and essentially a white body with a bit of a dark cap, and the tern's precisely the same. But their resemblances end because, first of all, terns are, well, about half the size, but the shape of the tern is much more elegant. I mean, they have long wings, quite a sort of flat head, a long spiky bill, and the whole thing is much more aerodynamic, so much more graceful. I don't know who designed them, but like evolution did a good job.
They all migrate huge, long distances, but they have different, each species has its own route around the globe.
Yeah, the common terns, I mean, you could almost kind of like take your hat off to them because they winter around the coast of Africa, you know, from West Africa right down to Namibia, and then they arrive back here in late April every year. But Arctic tern really sort of knocks that into a corner because it breeds primarily in the Arctic regions of the planet, and the entire global population trek all the way south to sort of spend the winter time around the edge of the Antarctic continent.
Of all the different tern species around the world, then each have just, I guess, found their own niche, their way of life working for them, and it's continuing through the genetic heritage.
That's precisely it. In Ireland, we have half a dozen species of terns which breed, and everyone has got a different life story. They're all kind of doing something which works for them, and they're not all doing the same thing. There's been a lot of interest in tracking, not just terns, but all birds. But, you know, Arctic tern is such a dream candidate because of the distances that it travels. So teams of researchers, they have fitted little tracking devices called, they're called geolocators. So they've got up to 90,000 kilometres per annum for an Arctic tern. But they reckon if they could put some loggers on birds which breed on the coast of Russia, they'd probably hit 100,000 kilometres per annum.
100,000 kilometres. So these tiny little birds on the railings that are no bigger than a swallow, they go 90,000 kilometres flying across the oceans every single year.
Oh.
What are they now?
That's the terns.
They're the terns.
That's the terns. That's lovely.
One of the things that really blows my mind is these terns, many of them have been born just this summer, just a couple of months ago, and what, they take a couple of weeks, 3 weeks after they've hatched, they're already flying, their parents teach them how to fish, and then a few weeks later they set off for the Antarctic. How do they know how to fly, where to go, how do they find their way? It's incredible. It's not like they're flying alongside their parents or going in family groups, is it?
No, it is, and it's, I mean, the whole kind of sense of wonder that that journey generates, it is staggering, and I've been interested in birds all my life, and I still find it just mind-blowing, what they do, the distances they travel, and the fact that the young ones quite often fly unaccompanied. So, you know, people's head would explode to think, well, so a young tern is going to leave Ireland, and it's going to head down to the Antarctic, and it actually knows where to go. So, you know, from the egg it's laid, 3 weeks later it hatches. Roughly 3 to 4 weeks after that, you've got the young tern, which is now able to fly. So, you know, within a 10-week window, you go from kind of an egg with an embryo to a flying juvenile tern, which is independent, and it will leave here by, say, late July, August time, and by November it will be fishing around the edge of the Antarctic. Right up until the 1940s, it was not believed that the Arctic terns, which were found around the Antarctic landmass in the wintertime, were our birds. The view was that they're actually a species which lives down there year-round, or which, you know, they cannot possibly come from the Northern Hemisphere all the way down to the Southern Hemisphere. So it's now known from the scientific data that the birds from Western Europe, the Arctic terns from Western Europe, they kind of head down towards the coast of South Africa, off the west side of South Africa, on the Benguela Current, mainly off Namibia. Then they round the Cape of Good Hope, and then they actually head across the bottom of the Indian Ocean. But they will use a staging area to kind of halt the journey for a while, for like maybe up to a month, And again, the data from the loggers has kind of pinpointed precisely where they stop. So it's not that they stop along a nice sandy coast and catch lots of kind of fish in the shallows. They're way out, thousands of miles from the Ayers land. In fact, the area where they go to, and again, it was thanks to these little loggers that scientists now know that this is the spot. This is like their kind of like holy grail for another destination on their journey. It's a place called Amsterdam Island, which is roughly midway between the sort of Perth of Western Australia and the tip of South Africa. So it's like a dot in the middle of the Southern Ocean, where the deep cold water of the Pacific wells up near the surface, and it creates incredibly rich feeding ground. So it's not just terns, there's albatrosses and all sorts of southern seabirds that are there too.
But how do they know where they're going? Like, how do they navigate to find their way there? And then even when they get to this Amsterdam Island, how do they know that they're there?
Good question. They're kind of preordained to follow a migration route that their forebears followed successfully. There are elements of the natural world, of planet Earth, that organisms can tap. It's not just birds, but if you think of other things which perform incredible journeys, for example, the great whales or sea turtles.
So bird species might be able to use the stars or the tilt of the sun or the sun above the horizon or things like that to navigate, visual cues. But you're saying that's not all, because the whales and turtles don't have that option.
Precisely. And the truth of the matter seems to be that anything which migrates or which even navigates, it doesn't have one system. It actually kind of integrates several systems. It may prioritise tracking the sun. It may prioritise the sky at night. Or it may prioritise the pull of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, not just terns, but all birds, in fact, all life forms sense this. And in fact, the organism that's the odd one out is called Homo sapiens, i.e. us. So there was an assumption that the birds actually kind of were able to tap into the star patterns, and they could kind of use that for the nighttime migration, especially as most bird migration happens at night, not during the day. So the notion that they were actually using star patterns was turned out to be a complete bunkum. It was wrong. But they are using the night sky, and what they actually use is the rotation of the night sky around a fixed point, which in the northern hemisphere is Polaris,
the
North Star. Because if you were to take a photograph and do a time lapse, if you pointed your camera at the sky and left the shutter open for say 10 minutes and looked at the results, you'd get these lovely star trails. But they're around a fixed point, and that fixed point is Polaris. And in the southern hemisphere, there is no Polaris, but you'll still get the star trails.
That is just mind-boggling, how these tiny little birds here in Dublin Port, what they're about to do. They're just about to take off in this migration now, aren't they?
This is peak time. We've been sitting here having a lovely afternoon, listening to terns cruising past behind us, but, you know, they're probably all looking at their watch going, like, time to shift. You know, it's nearly August, and we've got to be somewhere else.
My little wings will fly a million miles out of sight, far over the ocean blue. No autumn, no winter, only day and night, far over the deep blue sea. Far over the ocean, far over the sea, seasons turn not for me. Seasons turn not for me. My love flies in spirals and colors to our lips, far over the ocean blue. We're lovers for a season, or maybe for the rest, far over the deep blue sea. Far over the ocean, far over the sea. Seasons turn, but not for me. Seasons concern, not for me. I will follow starlight in the turning of the sky, far over the ocean blue. Shingle in my song and glitter in my eyes, far over the ocean blue. Far over the ocean, far over the sea, seasons turn not for me, seasons turn not for me, seasons turn not for me, seasons turn not for me.
Was an original song written and performed especially for this episode by Brian McGlynn, inspired by Arctic Tern's incredible global migration. Terns are sleek and elegant and supremely impressive in every aspect of their lives. It's not surprising then that their romantic rituals are also something special. Terns are monogamous, mating with the same partner year after year. Pair bonds often last for decades. Because both parents incubate the eggs and both parents bring food to the growing chicks, choosing a good partner right from the start is especially important for these birds. In spring, having returned from distant seas, unmated males do their best to impress watching females. They show off their agility in flight and how good they are at catching fish. Courting couples then perform a beautiful aerial ballet together, demonstrating their agility and stamina to one another and forming the beginnings of a lifelong bond. The courtship display always follows the same set pattern. First, the pair ascend into the sky together, spiraling as they go. Then they cross one another's flight trajectory in a close pass, before descending rapidly together in a graceful twirl of precisely overlapping paths. The male also offers her fish, carrying it in his beak until she decides to accept. At such close quarters, they get a chance to really observe their potential mate. Fresh feathers glow with ultraviolet light patterns in wavelengths that we humans cannot see. They are dazzled by each other's shimmering feathers, catching the sunlight as they twirl and swirl over the sea. At the beginning of the mating season, terns are literally radiating good health.
Terns are a wonder to watch, graceful in flight and easy enough to recognize. They're silvery grey and white with black-capped heads, orange beaks and orange legs. Their distinctive forked tail streamers have earned them the folk name of sea swallows. A summer evening's walk along Dublin's coastline will almost always be rewarded with the sight of terns in flight. Even in the industrial heart of Dublin Port, with loads of activity and big ships coming and going throughout the day. And yet, terns have adapted to nest here, finding suitable nesting sites among this bustle. I can't help but admire them for their innovation at doing this. There are so many terns breeding in and around Dublin Port that on an international level, this population is really important. As a result, their breeding and foraging areas within the port are protected under the European Birds Directive. To make sure that this population is maintained, Dublin Port Company and Birdwatch Ireland have been working together to provide nesting sites in the areas of the port, including several pontoons that have been purpose-built for terns. Tara Adcock, Birdwatch Ireland's Urban Birds Project officer, brought us out along Dublin's iconic Great South Wall to view one of these nesting platforms.
Do you think we'll see any terns out on the pontoon then today?
We're a little bit late on in the season, and then with avian flu as well, we had a bit of a failure across the colony, so we might be just a little bit late this year, but we could get lucky, or we might see some of the fledglings actually on the Great South Wall. So they kind of come from the Great South Wall pontoon, land on the Great South Wall, and are kind of trying to learn how to fish, and the parents are still coming in and feeding them. And you often see people walking up, and the tern parents are like coming down, dive bombing them to keep them away from the fledglings. So you'll see people just scattering. Well, these tiny, tiny birds are just like dive bombing them constantly. It's amazing. Not so great for the people, but it's really entertaining to watch. Yeah, you can hear them there. That's common terns. There they are, just going over.
And it's busy. It's a nice summer evening, full of cyclists and all the boats out in the bay as well, sailing boats.
It's smack bang in the middle of Ireland's busiest port. So, like, you've got about, this year we had about 550 pairs, just over that, of common and Arctic terns, mostly common terns, in the port. But there's, like, there's cargo ships going by, there's big, heavy cranes. It's very, very industrial, not so much here, but in the middle of the port. They've got these tiny, beautiful, fragile-looking creatures just flitting about in between and getting on with life. It's really, really cool. You can see them.
Oh, so I can actually see one eating a fish.
Can you?
Yes. It's got the fish skin is catching the sparkle in the sun. Tara, what is that big square platform just out off the south wall?
So that is the Great South Wall Pontoon. So it was deployed specifically for terns by Dublin Port Company back in 2015. It's a series of pontoons that are kind of strapped together. It has a gravel surface on top of it for the terns to nest on. And then it has different compartments as well within it. And they have chick shelters, so these wooden kind of shelters that the chicks can go in under during like times of really bad weather. But yeah, it's literally a breeding structure for terns, specifically put out for terns.
And these are all terns that we can hear screeching around us now.
Yeah.
And traditionally, terns nest all around the coast of Ireland, right? All the different species have lots of different locations.
Yeah, so they're mostly kind of on the west coast. On the east coast, they're much more restricted. We have fewer islands for them to nest on. So that's probably one of the reasons we're seeing them in the port. So we are seeing this shift of terns from their more natural habitats, so these offshore islands, onto kind of man-made structures like ports. Down in Cork, there's terns nesting in Cork Harbour as well. And the reason that they're nesting in these harbours is we have created these structures that look like islands. So terns have evolved to nest on islands because these areas were traditionally free of mammalian predators. So they see, like a pontoon like that with a flat surface sitting on the water, that's an island. It's surrounded by water, that's an island. And in 2013, the Dublin Bay Birds Project was set up and funded by Dublin Port Company. And a large remit of the Dublin Bay Birds Project is to manage and look after and census the tern colony here in Dublin Port. And the reason that a project was set up for it specifically is it just means that there's more funding to look after them, that there's more time given over to monitoring them, because if you have more money, you have more time to manage the colony.
What can you do to improve the fate of the terns that are nesting in around Dublin Port?
Yeah, so a lot of things have been done over the years to improve the kind of quality of the habitat here for terns. So again, looking at the Great South Wall Pontoon, back in 2021, there was a massive problem with rats. So rats can swim over a kilometre in open water.
Wow.
So we were wondering, how on earth are we getting away with this? 2021, they made it onto the pontoon, and it was really depressing. We pulled up, moored up onto the pontoon, and there was just dead chicks everywhere. And we knew it was rats because of the way that they had been killed.
Oh, no.
So we were devastated. But not all was lost. There were still chicks there, still eggs, still time to react to it. So Dublin Port Company and Liffey and Port Marine Services, they reacted really, really quickly. And they came out and they put metal skirting boards that basically it's an overhang onto the pontoon. And they have baffles on the mooring chains as well, so rats can't climb up onto it. And it's like night and day. Next time we came out, no rats, And that pontoon did really, really well that year. So it just shows if you can react really, really quickly and you've got really good relationships with your stakeholders and they're really on board with nature in the area that you're looking after, that you can make a real difference for these birds and for nature in general.
What drew you to terns in the first place?
I personally think that they are one of the most incredible species on the planet. They're very, very small, they're very elegant. They are incredibly aggressive. Like, and you think that would be a detractor for them, but it's not. Like, up in the Arctic, they will literally attack polar bears and drive them away from their young. Like, they are just epic parents.
They attack polar bears?
Yes, and they're tiny. They weigh, like, they say about the equivalent of a lemon. So just a lemon with, like, a really, really sharp beak attached to it, just drive everybody away. So they're incredible. They're brave. They do these epic long migrations. They're just unbelievable species. They're just brilliant.
A big part of the conservation work in Dublin Port depends on some tiny plastic rings that specially trained ringers attach to the birds' legs before they fledge every year. These rings are a cheap and easy way to keep track of individual birds over the course of their lives and can be easily spotted from a distance or even logged online.
Colour rings are small plastic rings. They don't last as long as the metal rings, but each ring has its own code and that ring can be read in the field through a telescope. So that means it's an awful lot easier for us to get data back on these birds. That's really, really important. Understanding how these birds are moving, where they're going, their migration routes, how long they're surviving is really important from a conservation point of view because, take for instance, their migration. So if we know what areas are important for these birds along their flyway, so the area that they're using on an annual basis, then we know which areas to target for protection. And colour ringing is one of those things, when you're getting reports back from like Spain or Africa, it makes you realise that these birds are not just ours, and they're not just here, they're part of a wider network. And when we're trying to protect species, we need to be thinking on a bigger scale. We need to be thinking kind of holistically across the entire globe, because terns don't just depend on Dublin Port. The Dublin Port terns, they're not just here. They're also in Africa, they're in Antarctica, they're in New Zealand. So we really need to think about how they're protected right across the flyway. So that's one of the things that colouring helps us to do and really informs conservation practices, not just in Ireland, not just in the UK, but right across the globe.
Are you in contact with conservation organisations along their migration route then as well?
Yeah, so there's one in particular, the Kartong Bird Observatory down in the Gambia and Senegal. So we've gotten information from them about some of our terns, which are our terns, Dublin Bay terns, which are which they've seen down on their migration. So that's been really cool. But a lot of it is actually from individuals. So individual people going out and taking a just with a telescope or with a camera and taking photographs of these birds or reading their inscriptions and sending them back to us. So it's a really good way of building relationships with people that you wouldn't otherwise ever speak to because they're so far away. So that's been a really lovely part of the job as well. We had one Arctic tern actually, so we haven't gotten that many reports back of Arctic terns because we've ringed a lot fewer of them than common terns, but there was one Arctic tern that fledged from the colony and a few months later was on a boat in Nigeria. It got entangled up in the rope and one of the guys working on the ship went up, untangled it, bred the ring, released the bird. The bird seemed absolutely fine and we got that report back. It was just a ship docked off of Nigeria. Would never have talked to him otherwise. It's just really lovely kind of contact that we got. I'm not trying to be all doom and gloom, but it's an awful lot of pressure that these birds are under. And it's a real sign that our natural world is under significant pressure. And I think that's one of the things that birds, terns, and all birds, all species of birds do for us, is that they're so noticeable and they're so present in our lives that we can see them. So they're a really good indicator of just how much pressure we're putting on the world. They're a really, really visceral way of seeing just how much damage we are doing to the planet, but they're also a really good way of seeing how much hope there is as well, because you, if you're working, say, in Dublin Port, and you have these incredible stakeholders who are really, really doing their best for the terns, and they're predator-proofing these pontoons, and you're seeing it literally, like, in real time, the difference that just stopping predation happening at one pontoon is making for these birds. It does give you a little sense of hope that if we do work together and we do have the interests of the natural world at the forefront of our mind, that we can actually make a difference. Like, there is hope. There is hope. And I think that's one of the things that we are forgetting with the constant news cycle of how bad everything is. There is hope. We just have to work. We have to support each other in that work.
Once we understand their patterns and their needs, and we can cater for them and go out of our way to protect the breeding territory or providing their...
Totally. And that's why this management work and this conservation work is really, really important, because we can't protect what we don't understand.
Father, will I know where I'm going? Father, will I know where I'm going? Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mammy-o, we're fishing on the shingle in the morning. You're going where the sun is ever shining. You're going where the sun is ever shining. Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mammy-o, we're fishing on the shingle in the morning. Flying to a home on the horizon. Flying to a home on the horizon. Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mammy-o, we're fishing on the shingle in the morning.
The Irish for terns is gavrog, which sounds to me like it has the same root as the word gabrucht, which means chatting. Chatty seems like an apt description for the sounds of their breeding colonies in summertime too. Another word used for terns is skrechog hra, or beach screecher, a familiar sound to anyone used to fishing on shingle coasts where terns are busy flying back and forth. Considering that terns nest in places where human presence is scant, like offshore islands and remote shingle beaches, it's no wonder that they don't have a presence in Irish folklore. But terns had somewhat of a starring role in the establishment of the modern conservation movement, and that's a story worth sharing here. During the 19th century, populations of terns were hammered by hunting and egg collecting. Then a Victorian craze developed for ladies to wear feathers in their hats. Robins, wrens, goldfinches and kingfishers were all targeted, though terns were hit especially hard. Plume hunters would raid tern colonies during the breeding season when the birds were most vulnerable, often leaving chicks to starve or be taken by predators. But this was a profitable trade for many, and little heed was paid to the enormous destruction of bird life exacted by milliners and others for purely decorative purposes. And meanwhile, wild populations of terns were being inadvertently exterminated. Then, two Victorian ladies, realizing the destructive nature of the plumage industry, decided to take action. Frustrated by a lack of interest within the all-male British Ornithologists' Union, Eliza Phillips and Margareta Lemon founded the Society for the Protection of Birds. After over 30 years of tireless campaigning, the organisation, now known as the Royal Society of the Protection of Birds, managed to ban the hunting and sale of birds for feathers. The RSPB is now one of the strongest conservation organisations, with over 1.2 million members. From small beginnings, massive movements are born.
Little terns are Ireland's smallest tern. They spend summer days flying back and forth between shingle shore and the open sea, catching small fish among the waves and returning to share their catch with their fluffy little chicks back on the shore. Once the young have fledged and the whole family are well fed, little terns set out on migration routes that will bring them all the way to Senegal, Nigeria, Côte d'Ivoire, Ghana, Togo and Sierra Leone. Brian and I visited Kilcool Beach on the coast of County Wicklow, where a conservation project has been running since 1985 to help protect the nesting colony of little terns there. We walked the shore with Brian Burke, who is the Little Tern Project Manager with Birdwatch Ireland. First up, I wanted to know where the terns who nest around the coast each summer have travelled from.
When they migrate north at the end of the spring, they tend to do it in a couple of days. They're in a big rush to get back to their breeding grounds, get their little nest site and get up and running. So they'll do that in a couple of days.
A couple of days?
Yeah, it's really hard to comprehend that, you know, imagine they don't just kind of randomly pick a site every year. They come back to nearly, you know, within a couple of square feet of exactly where they were the year before and the year before and the year before. And some of them could be nesting decades in the same corner of a colony.
And for the little terns here in Kilcool, that's a huge mileage to be clocking up each year if you think they're going to live to 15, 20 years and they go all the way down to Africa each summer and all the way back each spring.
Yeah, if you think swallows are impressive, look at the little terns and, you know, they live much, much longer than the likes of swallows and they're nesting in these really precarious places on beaches and having to struggle to find fish in the sea and all that kind of stuff, but they do it and, you know, if we give them a little bit of a helping hand here with these kind of conservation projects, they do it really well.
And once they arrive, the terns don't waste any time before mating and laying a little clutch of eggs in among the pebbles on the beach. But these eggs and the newly hatched chicks are almost impossible to see.
I've seen the eggs during the nesting season and they are so hard to spot. They blend in perfectly with the shingle. Are the chicks as camouflaged as their eggs?
Yeah, they really are. You know, when you go out to walk out, even though you know it has to be here within a couple of feet of where you're standing, it's impossible to find them. It really, sometimes it takes a few minutes of staring around and just waiting, you know. And the chicks tend to sit very still as you get closer and they're just perfectly camouflaged.
And this is why they're so vulnerable to trampling.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing. One of the big risks for little terns in particular is that they are so well camouflaged. They do pick these coastal beaches. You know, Kilcool here is quite popular with walkers and people with dogs and stuff during the summer. And, you know, without any bad intentions at all, you could accidentally, you know, step on a nest, step on a chick, or a dog could find it, or something like that.
Life is getting more and more difficult for terns, and their populations are still dangerously low. It's become harder for them to find suitable breeding habitat, undisturbed beaches, to rear their chicks. Sometimes the shoals of small fish that they depend on aren't there either, and foxes and crows have become more abundant too, so more and more eggs and chicks get snatched away. For this, the wardens erect fencing each spring to protect the eggs and the chicks.
There is a nest that's further up there, I think, so we just won't walk
Fantastic.
Any further.
Fantastic.
Yes, this is a flexi-net fencing, and we do have some electric fencing on the outside as well. And it's to make the colony obvious to people, but also to keep out predators like foxes and hedgehogs and things like that as well. So we have one set of fencing right around the outside of the colony, and then out kind of 2 metres in from that, we have a double layer of fencing. And that's because in years past, we have had issues with hedgehogs squeezing through the bottom of some of the fencing and coming in and predating eggs. So we have a double layer of fencing. The hedgehogs cannot squeeze through it. But that takes us about 2 weeks at the start of the season, a team of us, to put it up, make sure the fence posts are deep in the ground so they're not going to get washed away or blown over, make sure the fencing is, you know, is solid and tight and nothing's going to get through.
I never would have thought of hedgehogs as being a predatory threat to anything other than slugs. That's quite funny.
Yeah, they look so innocent, you know, but yeah, unfortunately it can be a problem.
And you've got wardens here 24/7 throughout the breeding season.
Yeah. 24/7. You know, over the years, I suppose a lot of different strategies have been tried, but in the last few years, between the National Parks and Wildlife Service and ourselves, we decided that it needs to be 24/7. Unfortunately, if you're not here for an hour, that can be all something like a fox needs or a hooded crow to come in and wipe out a huge part of the colony. And that goes right to the end of the breeding season as well. You know, we've had foxes come in literally the last few days of July when there's fledglings on the beach and they're able to fly and everything. But it comes in at night and we've had this clearing out, you know, predating fledglings and adults, you know, and these birds that have worked so hard over the summer, they've gotten to the stage where the chicks are flying and in a night a fox can wipe out 10, 15, 20 birds and it's heartbreaking and it just shows, I suppose, the the level of vigilance that's needed here, you know?
And I mean, this is nature at work, a fox coming in and preying on chicks. But the reason why that's so, that the population here is just so low, it's taking a couple of chicks or a few dozen chicks has a massive impact, right?
Like it has. And if they take them from here, absolutely, 10, 20 chicks or 10, 20, you know, 5, 10 adults even has a nearly a national level impact on this population. Like, foxes are absolutely fantastic animals. If I see a fox close to me at home, you know, it's the highlight of the evening. Really, really amazing creatures, but we just can't afford to have them down here, unfortunately. You know, humans have changed the landscape and they've changed kind of the wildlife that we have here, and foxes do very well in that landscape. Little terns don't do very well. So, yeah, we need to give little terns a chance.
Actually has a sand eel in its mouth, does it, or a worm or something?
Sand eel or a sprat, I would say, but yeah. So the parents will feed them after they've fledged, you know, and kind of wean them off, I suppose, over the next couple of weeks.
And how do they catch the sprat or sand eels? Do they dive into the water?
They do this little hover when they've kind of spotted something. They kind of stop, hover a little bit, and do this little plunge dive, and just take those fish just out of the kind of the top foot or so of the water.
Look, you can actually see it hanging out of its mouth.
Yeah, and it's quite a big fish as well, yeah.
They are so beautiful. They really are graceful and elegant, aren't they?
Yeah, they're absolutely fantastic.
The wardens really have their work cut out for them here, making sure that as many of the chicks as possible are successfully fledged. And once this happens, terns tend to live for a very long time.
It must be quite an experience to spend a summer as a warden here on Kilcool or in Rockabill or anywhere else, and spending every day watching these birds and watching over them and protecting them. I wonder how much of a relationship, how much you've come to really care about the well-being of these birds.
Yeah, like, you know, we're scientists at the end of the day, but and you're not really meant to get attached to your subjects, so to speak, but if you're watching these birds from the day they arrive and through all the hardship of finding a mate, laying eggs, raising chicks, you can't help but get attached. You know, they're really fantastic birds. You really do get this close bond. It's heartbreaking to see, you know, when they don't succeed, and especially with the likes of avian flu as well, when the adults are dying too. But it's really, really heartwarming when they do well, you know, and we do our absolute best for them.
We'll walk up the beach and see if we can see any more.
Yeah.
And how many little terns do you have nesting here each year on Kilcool?
So last year was a record number. It's about 205 nesting pairs of little terns, which is about half of the Irish population. That has grown from, you know, it was much lower. It was certainly below 100 at the start of the 2000s. And the numbers have gone up and up and up with all of our conservation efforts between, you know, Birdwatch Ireland and the National Parks and Wildlife Service. It's been really, really successful. And we know then from ringing studies and other other conservation projects that birds from Kilcool that have fledged from here a few years ago have gone on to nest at other colonies. So Kilcool not only kind of supports Kilcool, but it's helping to kind of seed other locations and new colonies as well.
And I can see a load of them flying about above the waves here just in front of us. Are they all little terns?
Yeah, they're all little terns. Yeah, it's really, really satisfying for the wardens and for myself. You know, you're watching these birds from the day they arrive on the beach. You know, they're 3 weeks of incubating their eggs, 4 weeks of raising the chicks, and then to see those chicks take their first flight, you know, they start to look a bit more like adults at this stage of the season and getting more and more competent with their flying, and it's just really wonderful to watch. I never get bored of it.
It's hard to comprehend the lives of these little seabirds. Life is so precarious, yet they have relationships that last for decades and make journeys each year that we could only dream of.
Lover, will you follow me away now? Lover, will you follow me away now? Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mommy-o, we're fishing on the shingle in the morning. We all fly our own way alone, love. All fly our own way alone, love. Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mommy-o, we're fishing on the shingle in the morning. I'll see you back here in the year, love. I'll see you back here in the year, love. Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mammy-o. We're fishing on the shingle in the morning. I'm looking down along the coast of Wicklow. I'm looking down along the coast of Wicklow. Dance to your daddy-o, sing to your mommy-o. We're fishing on the shingle in the morning.
Over the past 60 years, the world population of seabirds has fallen by two-thirds. Overfishing is one of the key threats. The decimation of fish stocks is very much impacting terns too. Climate change compounds the challenges facing seabirds, affecting ocean currents and the movement of fish, as well as causing more severe storm events that have destroyed eggs and chicks in breeding colonies around Irish coasts. A whopping one-third of all seabird species are now threatened with extinction. Terns are representative of these global trends. That's why it's especially heartening to see how well conservation projects are working when it comes to terns.
Over the past 150 years, the story of terns has been defined by conservation. But that doesn't mean doom and gloom. Terns are an example of how resilient and inspiring the natural world can be. If we pay attention to the impact we're having and take action to heal the damage we've done. This requires thinking in the long term, thinking beyond borders, and maybe even finding our way in the dark. Just like terns, even if the only lights we can follow are the distant specks of stars, we have to follow these tiny glimmers of hope and believe that we will find a way to a safe and stable future for our entire planet.
Feather and Flock, Tern, was presented by the ecologist Anya Murray and the folk musician Brian McGlynn. The programme was produced by Anya Murray and the sound supervision was by Brian McGlynn. That closing tune was an adaptation of the traditional song Dance to Your Daddy-O, as sung by Elizabeth Cronin from Ballyvourna in County Cork, arranged and played on guitar by Brian McGlynn. Fishing on the Shingle in the Morning was written and performed by Brian McGlynn for this episode, inspired by the aforementioned traditional tune and the Terns' migrations. Another new song, Season's Turn, was also written and performed by Brian for this episode. All other music and score was arranged, written and produced by Brian on guitar, bouzouki, dulcimer, mandolin and synths. All soundscapes and birds were recorded in the field by Brian McGlynn and Sean Renane of Irish Wildlife Sounds. The Feather and Flock series is this year's winner of the Gold Award for Best Factual Series at the IMRO Irish Radio Awards, and we'll have the sixth and final episode Eagles next week here on The Lyric Feature, Sunday at 6 p.m. as always. And all the previous episodes are available from the RTE radio player, from the Lyric FM webpage, or wherever you get your podcasts. The series was made with funding from the RTE Independent Radio Productions Unit and from Cumashun na Mban's Sound and Vision Broadcasting Scheme, all paid for by your television licence fee.
You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
John Kelly's Mystery Train is next. That's coming up at 7 o'clock. But before that, more turns. And one place you might hear turns is in a marsh. And you'll definitely hear some in this next piece. Cantus Arcticus is described as a concerto for orchestra and wild birds. And in it, we hear the orchestra, in this case, it's the Scottish National Orchestra, in concert with actual recordings of wild birds. And in the movement, we'll hear Suo the Marsh. The recordings are made, as you'd expect, in a marsh. This is Suo the Marsh from Eino Juhani Rautavaara's Cantus Arcticus. It's played here by the Scottish National Orchestra, conducted here by the Finnish conductor Hannu Lintu. And Lintu, incidentally, is the Finnish for bird.